The following program, Building a Democracy Movement in an Age of Austerity and Corporatization, was sponsored by the Madison Institute in Madison, Wisconsin, on April 30, 2011. The featured speaker, Ben Mansky, is executive director of the Liberty Tree Foundation and co-founder of Wisconsin Wave. He is introduced by Constance Trinan, chair of the board of the Madison Institute. The program was held at the Capitol Lakes Health Center Auditorium in Madison. Now, Constance Trinan.
I think probably most of you remember his name first coming to the news when he was a student leader back in the 1990s and really portrayed as someone who was pretty far out. And we don't find many people who are farther out than we are, do we? But anyway, it's very good to know that he's still active. He grew up in Madison, went to the schools here in Madison, graduated from the UW Law School, etc. So we're very glad that he's still here and doing good things for us. He points out that he's been around quite a bit to other campuses. He's not just Madison area. And I see he says he's been from Caracas to Seattle to Barcelona. So that's pretty good. And I don't think he was just sightseeing. Okay, he has published quite a bit. He has his own law firm now. He's a public interest attorney. And he says he's a pro-democracy advocate. That's one of the first things he puts in his bio. And I have a feeling there's some people here who might add that same thing. He actually was running for the assembly last time around, and probably you all know quite a bit about him. I'll tell you at least what he lists right now as his activities, and I thought the most interesting one was the pro-democracy advocate. That's something we could all list, you know, when you have to list when you make a contribution these days, you have to list your activity. And I hate to put retired. And like all of you, most of us are retired, but not spending our time twiddling our thumbs. So you can call yourself a pro-democracy advocate. He is executive director of his own foundation, the Liberty Tree Foundation, and he's co-founder of Wisconsin Wave. And I'm hoping he's going to tell us some about these things. Right now, there are so many groups that are trying to counter the administration that we have both here and in Washington that I can't keep track of all of them. And you're probably involved in some of them, too. And I like this one, too, Ben. He is co-owner of the Green Business Network, PosiPair.com. And he's also a member of the sociology faculty at MATC, which is now, of course, calling itself Madison College, which I think is a little confusing. I wish they'd make it Madison Technical College or something like that. Anyway, he is that. And he is involved in the American Federation of Teachers, AFT 6100. Associate Fellow, this is one you'll all recognize, with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. So, with all that, I am very happy that Ben Mansky is here this morning, and he will take questions when he's through speaking, and I'm sure he'll have lots of them. So, Ben Mansky.
Well, it's really an honor. It's really an honor to be invited. I told Sarah the fact that I've been invited to address the members of the Madison Institute shows that I've made it because of the work that you all have done throughout your lives and are doing right now. It's really something that I honor, and I want to thank you for taking your Saturday morning to spend with me. And I appreciate the introduction. It's a very lengthy bio that's from my campaign website, so you really stuck with it there. I will say that I have trouble keeping up with everything that's going on around the state. I don't know a single person who is playing any kind of active role, whether you're talking about the heads of state-level unions or state-level organizations or people who are involved at the grassroots around the state, who has a very clear sense of all the moving parts. And in some ways, that's a good thing. That's a sign that we have a true social movement that is afoot in the state of Wisconsin, that it's bigger than any small part, and bigger than certainly bigger than the sum of the parts. There are continually new initiatives that are moving in. There have been many times in recent weeks and months when I have had to remind myself of the saying that it is always darkest before the dawn. And in those moments when I've had fear, both for my family, but also for the state that I love, fears that Wisconsin would no longer be Wisconsin, I've had to remind myself of times in the past when I lay awake at night worrying and struggling. I'm sure there are many people in this room who have that experience as well. And there are a couple stories that I've reminded myself of. I remind myself of the moment in the 1990s when a warrior band of the Bad River Ojibwe, the Okichi-Da, had camped out on railroad tracks that go through the Bad River Reservation in Ashland County, the far north of Wisconsin. And how worried so many of us were that this small group of men were mostly much older than I was at the time, and still would have been today, were in a lot of danger. They were there by themselves. Most people around Wisconsin didn't know of it. Most folks didn't know that it happened at the time. But they were blocking the shipment of sulfuric acid to a acid mine project in the UP. And the plan of the railroad company was to ship the sulfuric acid through the reservation. And I remember the day that Governor Tommy Thompson put out a call for the FBI to come in and to intervene. And the next thing that happened was that the county sheriff, the Ashland County Sheriff, decided he really didn't want the FBI coming into his county. And he exercised some local democracy, and he put his squad car across the railroad tracks. Okay. That story, that experience of seeing that happen, has always inspired me to see the police. That was really the first time I had seen the police take our side. To see a police force actively take the side of the people here in Wisconsin. Not just any people, but Indian people in northern Wisconsin. I remind myself of the years in the 1990s, post-NAFTA, when we were probably, most of the people in this room, were working together with many others to stop the effects of NAFTA, to try to get NAFTA rolled back, to fight the Multilateral Agreement on Investments, the MAI, to push back against the early FTAA, Free Trade Area of the Americas, agreement negotiations that were going on, and of course, most centrally, to take on this plan to strengthen the World Trade Organization, to take the GATT agreements and to turn it into this nearly all-powerful global regulatory organization called the WTO. And of course, in the weeks and months leading up to the Seattle protests, there were many of us around the country who were urging people to go, who were organizing nonviolent direct action trainings, who were holding teach-ins. But it felt pretty dark in those years in the late 1990s. As Sarah, my wife, who is here, was saying to me this morning, that was an era in which many people in the United States did not believe that there was a left. They did not believe that there was a progressive movement. That's something that has actually changed, I'd suggest, since then. But we were trying to prove that there was a left, and we could only hope that we would be able to eventually roll back the World Trade Organization. I'll tell you, on the Friday of the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle, after Clinton had declared martial law and sent in the National Guard, after literally thousands of people had been gassed and pepper sprayed and beaten in the streets of Seattle, to see the unions go on general strike in Seattle, shut down the ports, and the WTO negotiations come to a halt was a great moment. So I remind myself of that, how wonderful it felt to look in every direction in downtown Seattle and see tens of thousands of people out there with us. I remind myself of the anti-sweatshop protests where Sarah and I met in the 1990s through the anti-sweatshop movement here at UW-Madison. And again, of how our activism was mocked by some in the newspapers, by the Badger Herald, by the Daily Cardinal. When we had our first sit-in at Bascom Hall, they editorialized against us. They said these tactics were too extreme. They belonged in the 1960s, and I agree. Sit-ins did belong in the 1960s, but they also belonged in the 1990s and 2011 as well. But by the end of the week, they had reversed themselves. And we actually, our movement, received an apology from the Badger Herald. The entire staff of the Badger Herald switched sides. I will say that they were all fired the following summer. But some of those people are still they're professional journalists in the trade, and it was a transformative moment for them as well. So I remind myself of those moments. And then, of course, I also remind myself that in the case of social change, It's always darkest before the dawn because, you know, when it's dark, well, actually, let me rephrase this. But of course, I also have to remind myself in these moments that social change is a little different than nature, right? This is human nature, not wild nature. And that in those moments when it feels darkest before the dawn, that's the moment in which you light a candle. And when enough of us light a candle, we bring the dawn. And that is actually how social change happens. So that's what's been happening in the last couple months. It has felt very dark at various moments, but more people than we know have lit a candle, have brought light to the state of Wisconsin, and we are bringing a new dawn to this state. So I feel very good, and I just wanted to start on an up note about the reality that even though most of the world doesn't realize that Wisconsin is still winning, we are still winning. We are still winning. The collective bargaining attack is still on hold. I think I talked to my grandmother the other day. She thought we had lost. I said, no, Grandma, we're still winning here. And I think everybody here deserves a round of applause and thanks for that. So, yeah, thank you. Now, I do want to bring us back to the darkness. I want to recognize that we have been, even in these moments when we've been in these individual battles, there has been a larger struggle that we have been immersed in, and that really for my entire adult life, I came of age at the end of the Cold War, we have been in a period, in an economic historical period, that I would characterize as a period of corporatization. It's really a period that began in earnest at the end of the Cold War, and there are reasons for that. But it's essentially a period in which multinational corporations have come to the fore, and they have pursued an agenda of transforming every sector of life, every sector of society, in a way that makes our daily lives less accountable to we the people and more accountable to those who own and run the major corporations of the world. And so if you look at any sector of human life, if you look at public education in terms of the K-12 sector, and you see the massive investment in transforming our public schools into essentially publicly subsidized private schools that are owned and operated by corporations, whether you're talking about vouchers or private charter schools and other movements like that. Or if you look at higher education, where you see this move here at UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee, and now it turns out at the newly branded Madison College to separate off core campuses in our public university systems and to create a corporate authority to manage these institutions in which we the people have invested literally hundreds of billions of dollars. I've told the chancellor at UW-Madison, I've said, if you really want to go ahead with this, I want my money back. I don't know what the valuation of UW-Madison is, but it's got to be in the hundreds of billions, if not more, in terms of just that institution alone. But they really have an agenda for higher education that I could certainly get into in great detail with you in discussing. And certainly education is not the only area. We're familiar with the corporatization of the media. I think everybody in this room has witnessed that in the course of our lives. There are new areas where corporations are boldly going, where no corporation had gone before. You have the private military companies that are attempting to essentially take over the Department of Defense and are largely succeeding, to the extent of which there are now more women and men under arms and providing support services in Iraq and in Afghanistan who work for private military companies, these private corporations, than actually serve in the United States Armed Forces. You see the corporatization of the legal sector, with a move to take arbitration out of the public courts and into private hands. You see the corporatization of the genetic code itself. Really, there is no sector that international capital has left untouched. So that's the moment that we've been in. And I think it is important just to remind ourselves of how this agenda of corporatization has moved ahead, how the agenda of taking something which was public or which might have been held privately by an individual, by a living, breathing human being, and is how those institutions, that sector of capital has been made into something which is owned and operated by major corporations and restructured in a way that is only accountable to those who run and operate those corporations. So how has this corporatization agenda moved ahead? Well, first of all, as I think many of you know, If you are in a position of power and you want to avoid any kind of concerted opposition, it is handy to distract them, to divide them, to create a sense of urgency, to create a sense of crisis. And of course, Naomi Klein is famous most recently for her work in the shock doctrine and exposing the role of imposed crises in allowing those who have something more to gain, they've already gained plenty, to consolidate their power. That's what the economic crisis that we face today essentially is. It is imposed austerity. We live in a moment in which we have the ability right now to provide single-payer universal health care to every citizen and every resident of the United States of America, to eliminate tuition at all public universities and colleges in the United States. And we can do both of those things simply by ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan now. That's it. Imagine that, free higher education in the United States. The greatest, and I will just say this is a pet issue for me because I suffer under it, but I also see it with my students. The greatest generational debt in U.S. history is that it's held by people my age and younger, and it stems entirely from student loan debt. I think about that, and it makes me angry. It makes me angry, to be frank, that we have the capacity to eliminate this kind of economic hardship, and it's failed to happen. So we do need to recognize that economic austerity is imposed. We've seen that here in Wisconsin, where on the one hand, Scott Walker offers $140 million in tax breaks for his friends, provides $80,000, $90,000 a year jobs to unqualified sons of his campaign contributors, and then at the same time says that public sector workers who are already facing foreclosure and higher rates of suicide and other types of social ills must take a 15% effective pay cut. So this is imposed austerity, and what you do essentially through austerity is that you create conditions of scarcity so that public sector institutions are placed in a position of having to decide whether they take additional financing from the corporate sector, or whether they deal with a devil, right? So just as one illustration, I'm sure there are others that are coming to mind, what's happening at UW-Madison right now is a perfect illustration of how imposed economic austerity leads to corporatization, inevitably. The students at UW-Madison and at MATC and a number of us who are faculty at both campuses and staff had a sit-in on Tuesday at Bascom Hall, and there was a long discussion that followed. The students had decided that they were going to stay until the chancellor came out and had a negotiation and a discussion with them on their terms. They'd had enough of being talked at. They wanted to have a two-way discussion. And she came out and she explained very clearly where she was coming from. She said essentially that What Chancellor Martin said essentially was that she had decided to go along with the governor because it was the only choice that was offered to her. And she directly quoted Margaret Thatcher. It was amazing to me that she didn't realize that she was quoting Margaret Thatcher. The students realized, the political science students there recognized she was quoting her, but she said there is no alternative. There is no alternative to this corporatization model for UW-Madison. There simply is not enough funding. We are in this situation. I have to save this institution. She didn't say she had to save her $400,000 a year salary, but she had to save this institution. And you can see the logic of her decisions as made from within her position, her social position, right? That she's looking at the road ahead of her and looking very narrowly at UW-Madison as an institution and acting as if UW-Madison were alone in this crisis, right? Number one, corporatizations moved ahead through the imposition of austerity and through the participation, I should say, of some public leaders in imposing corporatization on their own institutions, right? Number two, what has made it easier to forward this agenda has been the corporatization of government itself. And this is actually one of the areas that I think is most dangerous. I think it started earliest in the early 1980s, where, and I'm not saying there were no ills with our political system prior to 1980, But Wisconsin was actually in the midst of this as well, and maybe some of you were. La Follette versus Democratic Party of the United States, when Bronson La Follette was the Attorney General for the state of Wisconsin, the United States Supreme Court ruled that the Democratic Party of the United States, in other words, the DNC, right, the Board of Directors for the Democratic Party, enjoy First Amendment freedom of association rights to set the rules for the Democratic Party. And if the Democratic Party of Wisconsin or the state legislature in Wisconsin begged to differ about how delegates were to be selected from the state of Wisconsin, which Wisconsin Democrats did beg to differ, right? We had these little ideas about equity and representation for women and affirmative action, right? That was too bad. That essentially that the Democratic Party was a private corporation protected under the First Amendment, and that in terms of the party machinery, that was to be insulated to a certain extent from government regulation. Okay, so that was a first step that I think was pretty significant. Because after all, we do, as they teach us in the college textbooks, live in a two-party system. And the machinery of the political parties has a pretty significant impact on who is nominated and who takes office, right? So if that machinery, again, becomes insulated from public regulation, then we have a democracy problem. Okay? That problem has gotten much worse in the years since then. I remember 1996, there were maybe 35 of us. In fact, I remember the 35 because going through our phone list, this was before the internet was so commonly used. I remember those days too. And we had 35 of us who went down to Chicago for the Democratic National Convention in 96 to protest the corporatization of the Democratic Party. And I remember that there were many interesting incidents along the way. But one of those involved our then governor, our then Attorney General Jim Doyle, being feted at a banquet by Ameritech. And Ameritech had thrown a banquet for Jim Doyle, and he was supposed to be investigating him at that moment, right? So we made a sign, we made some banners, you know, and we made a banner, we made some signs, and we showed up there, and we did crash their party, like any 20-something radicals are supposed to do. But it was very visible, not only in that, but also just on the signs at the DNC around the city of Chicago, maybe some of you were there, where the corporate sponsorships of the convention were for the first time laid clear. They were bare. And today you have very heavy corporate sponsorship of the two major political parties in this country. You have the corporatization in the last 10 years, not only of the major parties, but also of voting itself, right? Where you have private corporations that not only provide the machinery of voting and the software and have a proprietary interest in that software to the extent at which we the people are not allowed to investigate and evaluate that software, but also in many jurisdictions around the country where they actually provide the tabulation themselves. You do not actually have public officials who are tabulating the vote. So I think I would suggest to you that if you have major corporations that are providing the major financing for the two major political parties in this country and which have effectively taken over the process of counting the vote in many parts of the country, then we have a very significant problem from our point of view. And on the other hand, it makes it certainly easier to ensure that officials who are sympathetic to the broader agenda take office and retain office around the country. And then the third thing that I see happening right now that I think has really threatens to drive the agenda of corporatization further along is this process, which I've only recognized in this way in the last couple weeks, maybe I was just slow, but it's the process of really establishing class rule in the Constitution. That's what Citizens United is really about, Citizens United, the FEC. I've spent many years working with many people nationally to educate about the doctrine of corporate personhood, to find new strategies to go after the corporation and the institution of the corporation. And to some extent, we had always been criticized by those who were self-identified Marxists as fetishizing the corporation. And I took those criticisms to heart. I sort of thought about them. And today, I finally recognize how correct they were. That essentially what Citizens United v. FEC, the the ruling that came down on January 21st of last year that said that corporations exercise First Amendment rights to invest in political campaigns, and that effectively struck down major provisions of McCain-Feingold. What that decision did was that it provided a major leap forward for the argument that money, that because money is speech, those with more money really should speak more than those without. And that it's very hard for, I think, all of us to understand. We have this antiquated notion of one person, one vote in the United States. We have this idea of the inherent equality of all people that we assume to be inherent American ideals, and I would argue they are. But there are these very, in my opinion, un-American legal doctrines that are being imposed on us that, in essence, would return us in a way to a constitutional framework more similar to that that was existent in pre-revolutionary America. They want to drive us back to before 1776. They want there to be two classes established in law, the corporate class and the rest of us. And that's what I think Citizens United was largely about. And I think you're going to see more and more bold statements coming from that sector in the coming weeks and months. So that's the mess we're in. And then the question becomes, what do you do about it? Am I still having? Yeah. I always have to check with my students when I... and normally they tell me that they're still with me, and I can't get inside their head yet to check. So then the question becomes, this is where the critical thinking comes in. I've asked them, actually we're going to ask them to solve the financial crisis for us on the exam this coming week, so I'll let you know what they come up with. But the question is how to respond. How do you respond to this crisis that has been created? It's an effective crisis for democracy. And I think there are a number of responses that we've seen. First of all, one response we see is a failure to respond. And I would suggest that most advocacy organizations, most unions, until recently, have utterly failed to even recognize that this process has been happening. They might, and that's simply because most of the people who do that work operate within a certain sphere, and they sort of they have their single issues that they're focused on. And many times it feels like they're under constant assault, because they are under constant assault. And it becomes very hard, to use, I guess, a war metaphor, when you're stuck in the foxhole, to get a sense of the larger battlefield, right? So I think that we have to recognize that still there are many who have failed to respond. More recently, I'd say especially in the last 6 months, you've seen a fight back that has emerged. And there are always those who will respond to some kind of crisis by pushing back and by protesting and by actively resisting it and by pointing fingers and saying, look what they're doing to us. It's immoral, it's illegitimate, and so on. And most of the activity that I think we've seen in the last couple months falls into that category of just a broad resistance, saying we refuse. Of course, the problem with that is that they have more money and more guns than we do. And in this country, we've stayed away from guns on the left for a long time, and I think that's a necessary thing. But in reality, those are the two sources of power that the state relies on. I think we have other sources ourselves that we bring to the fore. And you know, it's simply resisting is not enough in this moment. Simply resisting is not enough. Resisting worked very well in Seattle, but then several years later in Miami, when we were overwhelmed and out-organized, they shot us in the streets, and most of you probably didn't know about that. And how many people knew about the protests in Miami? How many people had never heard about the police suppression? Not an activist crowd, but there are a number of people, yes, people who I know who are very active. At the FTAA protests in Miami in 2003, there were 20,000 people out in the street, and essentially the police ran the media. The entire downtown area was where you literally had police captains out of uniform who were acting as anchors on the news, reporting what people in the city of Miami were seeing. And there were large sectors of Miami that were shut down, that were no protest zones. And the police opened fire with not only with tear gas and pepper spray bullets, but also with rubber bullets on us, and there were many people who were seriously injured there, and most of the world didn't find out about it, and our protests were stopped. So I guess my point just being that there's a moment for resistance, and then there's a moment to go beyond resistance. There are some who might respond to the crisis by calling for insurrection and simply saying, all right, all bets are off. It's time for a revolution right now. I don't think we're there yet. But I certainly, there were many people of my generation in the 1990s where that's where we were at that moment. And then finally, I think the final response that I think is the most logical one is to build a counter-movement. And for me, that's not just a progressive movement in a sort of broad sense, but it is in a more focused sense a democracy movement, a counter-movement that recognizes the agenda of corporatization for what it is and builds an active, broad-based, deeply rooted movement that calls for democratization of our institutions. And if you've ever heard me give a talk, you know I quote Vince Lombardi way too much, especially for somebody who is more a fan of football rather than football. I'm more of a soccer guy myself. But he had an expression which I think is very appropriate for us. He said that the best defense is a good offense. I think that's very much true when you look at what's happening in terms of the corporatization of public life, that we need to continue to go on the offense to develop an agenda for democratization of public life. So how do we do that? How do we build the pro-democracy movement? My approach, an approach of the Liberty Tree Foundation, has been to recognize that if you want to have a genuine democracy movement, it has to be very broad-based. It has to be deeply rooted all across the United States of America. It is not something that can be formed at a conference in Washington, D.C., or, God forbid, New York City. It is something that has to be based, frankly, in the Baraboos and the Madisons and the Lawrence, Kansases of the world. And that it is a movement that has to be built from the ground up. So what that means is that we need to strengthen campaigns for democracy in every area of public life. In the same way that you have private military companies that are increasingly taking the place of the United States Armed Forces in terms of military service, we need to be developing campaigns to democratize defense in the United States, to democratize defense, to make the United States military something that is more of the people, by the people, for the people. If there is going to be a military at all, which I will suggest to you that there will be for the foreseeable future, what does it look like? How do we make it more democratic? I can give you some specific examples. You can strengthen the role of the National Guard in terms of its relationship to the rest of the Department of the rest of the United States Armed Forces. Make the National Guard more independent. You can do that by initiating legislation at the state level, as we've done in 13 states, to require that for a National Guard unit is deployed overseas, that there be a check placed on that federalization order to ensure that the Guard is not being sent into harm's way without a lawful authorization of Congress. Okay, that's an entire campaign that we have developed. I can get into the details of it and the legal theory of it, and it's very well developed around the country, but it is something very specific, very concrete, where if that legislation were to be enacted, it would create a moment in which you would have a state standing up to the federal government and saying, no, you may not use our National Guard for occupation duty any longer, right? So that's one specific thing you can do. You can strengthen GI rights and strengthen the work of Iraq Vets Against the War and Veterans for Peace and the many organizations that are working to drive the Constitution and the Bill of Rights back into the military. You can push for a war referendum amendment, as prior generations have done. In the 1970s, it was called People Power Over War. Congressman Ron Dellum sponsored the legislation. In the 1930s, they came within 13 votes in the United States Congress of winning adoption of this amendment. But it's essentially an amendment that says that before the commencement of hostilities between the United States Armed Forces and another power, another country, unless the United States is directly militarily attacked on our home soil, right, that there must be a national referendum on war and peace. So they wanted to take power to declare war out of the hands of Congress. They didn't trust Congress. They were afraid that Congress was going to abdicate its authority to the executive branch, and unfortunately they were right. They wanted to remove that power from Congress. So we can push for that amendment. So there's three specific actions that can be taken to build pro-democracy campaigns in the defense sector. We can build campaigns for democracy in higher education, demanding elected boards of regents, full funding for public higher education, the reinstitution of firewalls against the corporatization of research. In 1926, the UW Board of Regents said no corporate money, no private money will be allowed into UW-Madison, right, in terms of providing any kind of subsidy. They saw that there was a real threat there, that firewall only lasted a short period of time until the Great Depression, but the reality is it is something that was possible then, and I would suggest, if you look at the financing of the UW, possible and necessary now. So there are many things you can do in the higher education sector. You can build movements for local democracy by strengthening home rule, which I think will be very necessary here in Wisconsin, is necessary in Michigan right now, where you see this imposition of essentially financial martial law on municipalities. We need to strengthen home rule provisions in our statutes and state constitutions to allow us to exercise local democracy and to protect local democracy from state governments that have been captured by the corporate sector. I can get into the details of this as well. You can strengthen participatory budgeting and participatory democracy at the local level by, for example, following Chicago's lead, where there are now a number of city council districts where the members of the Chicago City Council have turned over their little kitties, that several million dollars each of them have gotten through the machine politics of Chicago. Every member of the City Council in Chicago has several million dollars to play with, right? So there are a number of members of the City Council who have said, okay, I'm turning over my kitty to my constituents. And beginning with Alderman Joe Moore, and now there are, I think, four members of the Chicago City Council who are doing this, they have created a process of participatory budgeting in which literally thousands of their constituents come together and vote on where that money should go, what needs need to be served and filled first. So that's a way in which we can strengthen local democracies by bringing participatory budgeting to more municipalities in the United States. There are over 2,000 now cities around the world that practice participatory budgeting. There's only one in the United States, so let's build that. So I guess what I would suggest, I could go on and on. I've thought about this a lot. I've done a lot of this work. There are specific ways in which you can develop what I call democratic demands, demands for greater democracy, within every sector of human life, every sector of society, that altogether provide the basis for that broad-based, deeply rooted democracy movement, where every person, regardless of where they live, eat, pray, play, work, is engaged in campaigning for greater democracy in their daily life, right? And if you do that, then first of all, you end up with millions, potentially tens of millions, of small d Democrats, which is really, I think, our short-term goal here, is to create a culture in which people thirst for and struggle for and demand and expect participation, they expect democracy in their daily lives, and I think in the course of time, you get that democracy movement that this country so desperately needs. And then the final thing I just want to wrap up on before we get into discussion, I don't want to go too long, is I oftentimes get asked by certain people, so is this democracy movement reformist or revolutionary? And my answer is yes. It is potentially revolutionary to the extent that if there is a point at which movements for democratic reform hit a wall and they are unable to overcome that wall, then you enter into a transformative or revolutionary period. And you can see that at a sort of micro level, at a small-scale level, in moments like the ones that I cited earlier when I started off, the anti-sweatshop movement of the 1990s, where we had legitimate democratic reforms we were asking for, we were insisting on, we had done the organizing around. And finally, there came a point where we decided that the administration was stonewalling, and where we occupied the administration building. And as Chancellor Ward said when he gave in to us, he said, I had to establish, I had to give in, essentially, I'm just paraphrasing, because this was not just about sweatshops, this was about power, right? So what happened in that moment was that we challenged his authority, we demanded democratization, And he was willing to give in on some of those demands because he didn't want to lose his ability to govern entirely, right? A year later, there was a second sit-in. There were two sit-ins. Most people think there was one, but there were two, 1 year apart, where the next generation of activists went into to Bascom Hall. And they went in because the administration had failed to keep its promises. In that time around, the administration called in the riot police. They arrested 54 students in the dead of night, 3 a.m. on a Sunday morning after a week of protests. And we demanded the chancellor's resignation. And a week later, he resigned, right? I would suggest that was a revolutionary moment. It was a revolutionary moment for the UW-Madison because it established precedent for all the victories that have been won since at that campus. They all look back to the sit-ins, you know, in terms of what's happening today. And I think in terms of larger movement, I think pro-democracy campaigns and the democracy movement has a similar kind of duality to it. You demand democratic reforms, hopefully you win them. As you win them, your movement becomes stronger. People gain a greater sense of entitlement to participation and power. But in those moments in which the state refuses to bargain, then it becomes a revolutionary moment. And I think we need to be, frankly, serious about that. So I'll just end there. And I'm very eager to get into the discussion with you. And I do want to invite you to take part in the Democracy Convention that is happening, actually just two blocks from here, in late August. Very excited about this. So I'll end with an announcement and an invitation. This is something that my organization, Liberty Tree, has been preparing for a number of years, and which we finally feel ready to take on. But it's a national convention to bring together all those disparate types of pro-democracy activism: local democracy, media democracy, democratizing elections, work to build local democracy, work to build democracy in education, and bring them all together under one roof. And that roof will be the Concourse Hotel in the downtown campus of MATC, August 24th through the 28th of this summer. So I have some postcards which we can circulate, and you can also go online to democracyconvention.org. So let's open it up.
Charlie, you had your hand up first.
It seemed to me that there's a fundamental underlying question as to whether democracy and unconstrained capitalism can coexist. And one of the most frustrating things is to see the discussion about the state's budget crisis framed always in terms of where are we going to cut. It seemed to me the real issue is where are we going to find the adequate resources to fund the things that government is intended to provide in the way of services. One of the things that really struck me looking at some information, in 2010, the state of Wisconsin collected $4.7 billion less revenue than they did a decade ago. If Wisconsin businesses had paid just 75% of what they paid in 2000, we would have a $4.3 billion surplus in 2010. And I think that's an issue that somehow needs to get back into the discussion, put on the table, looking not just where we're going to cut, but how we're going to fund and finance education and health care and all the other things that are critical to a reasonable, civilized society.
I mean, that was something that I was very impressed to see the UW-Madison and MATC students, when they were speaking with the chancellor on Tuesday, that they were unwilling to allow her to get away with saying that the money is not there, which she repeatedly said, and they challenged her on that. I think that in those moments, in this moment, what you just said is what we need to be saying more of, and there's a reason why on the Wisconsin Wave buttons and on our banners and other materials, we say very clearly we won't pay for their crisis. The crisis we're in right now is a crisis that was created in a twofold way. First, most immediately, through the financial crisis of 2008 that caused so many of us to lose equity and lose real value that we had built up through our own work over the years. But also in a longer term structural way, we have been in this crisis of austerity and corporatization for many years. And so the problem of not only having a failure on the part of major corporations to pay taxes and being allowed to get away with that, but also the decline in the corporate income tax, and also, more importantly, in the state of Wisconsin, the decline in the top marginal tax rate, in the state of Wisconsin over the last 30 years is what has gotten us into this mess, as well as taking money that should have been invested elsewhere and blowing it overseas. So I think that we do need to be saying that assertively in every opportunity where somebody takes the out of fiscal austerity, and we need to not let them take that out and to blame their policies on that. But I think on the other hand, I think we need to even go a step further, because there becomes a point at which saying that we simply rejecting their logic is not enough. And that is why I think we do need to assert these demands for greater democracy in our society. Because they'll keep on saying it over and over again. They got CNBC, they got Fox News, they have the other institutions of the media. But until we build a counter movement from below, they'll keep on getting away with that.
I think part of the counter movement has to be also recognizing that we vote in a lot of ways. Every dollar we spend mm-hmm. is a vote. We vote every day in terms of the kind of institutions that we patronize and support. And I think there's an opportunity for us to be more actively involved in that way, in building and strengthening the economic institutions that are supportive of families, supportive of workers, that pay their taxes, that don't pollute the environment. And if we can figure out ways in which we can do that, not as a boycott, but a boycott, where we really direct our votes with the dollars that we spend into those institutions that are going to support and strengthen families and communities.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, and I'll say there will be an economic democracy track within the Democracy Convention as well, which the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops and various business activists, small business activists, are putting together. And it's essential. And one of the things that's been most promising to me in the course of the protest here in the last couple months has been the way in which institutions that historically have been largely alternative institutions, the cooperative sector, small businesses in the green economy, etc., have become more oppositional in the last couple weeks and months. That to see that shift from simply building an alternative to having that alternative become a base for resisting what's happening, I think has been really important.
Ben, I think it would help if you would mention some of these organizations. I think I'm involved in five or six, and I don't know whether there's any interrelationship or what. Tell us about Wisconsin Wave, for one.
Sure. So the Wisconsin Wave is a campaign. It's not really a standing coalition. It's not a standalone organization. It's a campaign that involves many individuals. And now, increasingly, there are organizations that are endorsing. We haven't been asking for endorsements, but organizations have been coming to us. So certainly be very happy of the Madison Institute, and here I am asking, were to endorse. I have Progressive Dane did this past week, and AFT Wisconsin is going to be taking it up this Sunday. But what the Wisconsin Wave is it is a prepared, deliberate strategy to resist corporatization and austerity in Wisconsin, and to essentially achieve two goals. These are not goals that we state publicly all the time, but these are our internal goals. Number one, to force the legislature to raise taxes on the rich, to do exactly what they don't want to do. And number two, to undermine the power of Wisconsin manufacturers and commerce to the point at which they are no longer such a factor in Wisconsin politics. So those are the two goals that we established in December of last year, okay? And so you're thinking, okay, December of last year, but the protests have been happening the last couple months. The reality in terms of the origins of the Wisconsin Wave is that it was very clear there was going to be a need for some kind of concerted, coordinated effort to resist austerity and corporatization in Wisconsin. We knew that Governor Walker was going to come after the public sector with a meat cleaver, right? And that we would need to organize something beyond the public sector unions to mobilize people. So that is what the Wisconsin Wave was and is. There are many, many other efforts that have taken root spontaneously around the state. What appears to me to be spontaneous. I'm sure they had their own logics to them. But essentially, we had hoped with the Wisconsin Wave to be at the point that we are already at. Let me back up. We had hoped by May of this year to have gotten to a point with our organizing that we might be able to turn 30 or 40,000 people out of the state capitol. And what happened to this project was that Governor Walker came at excuse my metaphor, he came at the public sector not with a meat cleaver, but with a chainsaw on February 11th. And of course, we hit that point of 30 to 50,000 people at the Capitol in a matter of weeks, not months, and the movement took off in a much more organic way than we had planned. But we're still moving ahead, and basically, I think what's very positive about the Wisconsin Wave is that we're in it for the long haul. We do have a very diverse set of organizations and constituencies that are involved. You can sort of see the sign of that in that the first, and so far I think, the first mass rally in which there was a very diverse set of speakers and of people present was the March 5th rally that we organized at the state capitol. That's commonly known as the Michael Moore rally because he showed up on 3 hours notice and gave a speech there. But the rest of the speakers were people who represented Freedom Inc., which is a community justice organization based in the Hmong and African American communities here in Madison that's very involved in fighting foreclosures in communities of color and many other things. We had Jim Goodman from Family Farm Defenders. We had Leland Pan from the Student Labor Action Coalition at UW-Madison. Matt Nelson from the National Civil Rights Organization Color of Change. And many more, the Sierra Club. So that's the kind of broad coalition of forces that we've been working to build with the Wisconsin Wave.
Well, I'm beginning to think that the Madison Institute has a responsibility for making a list of all these organizations and what they're doing. The ones I'm involved in are Wisconsin Voices, We Are Wisconsin, Better Choices for Wisconsin, which are mostly tax things. But that might be a service we can perform.
Yeah, and I would just say, I mean, there is communication between these different constellations of activity, and I think there's a certain division of labor that has emerged mm-hmm. between them, which I think is very positive. So Better Choices for Wisconsin, it represents primarily advocacy groups that are well established, that have done this work for many years around the budget process. We Are Wisconsin, very much led by the leadership of state-level unions, but it has broader participation as well, and sees itself more as a table than as an active campaign. So We Are Wisconsin sort of gets people to the table to talk with one another and hopes that things will come out of that and people will support one another. The Wisconsin Wave really is a campaign. We have a certain focus and there are certain steps that we're pursuing. And there are other efforts.
Okay, great. Next question, yes.
My name is Rob Lewis, and I'm a small business owner here in Madison. It's more of a comment than a question about how you are reaching out to the people who are not part of these coalitions, the people that really are affected by these policies, such as myself. And I've noticed, with all due respect to the group here, that I'm the third youngest in this room, and it's really disheartening to see so few young people in this movement. Although at the protests I see, in protests on the street, I see a very wide group of swath of age groups, but I was wondering if you could just sort of lift my spirits a little bit and tell me that there are a lot of people of all age groups that are really pissed off.
Rob, right?
Yeah.
No, I'm really glad you raised that. I mean, the Madison Institute is an older group in terms of its constituency, but what I will say is that there are things happening on the campuses and in the communities that are beyond me in terms of the level of activism. Sarah and I were downtown stopping by the post office to pick up mail, and I ran into one of my former students at Madison College who was on his way up to Bascom and said, "There's a protest going on right now. I'll see you up there." And I felt a little sheepish because I had no idea what he was talking about. I actually still haven't gotten a report from that yet. But there is a lot of activity happening on college campuses around the state right now. You know, I spoke to the United Council of UW System Students at UW-Stevens Point a couple weeks ago. Students around the UW system, not just in Madison, are very, very organized. There have been mass protests on the campuses around the state, at Stevens Point, at Oshkosh, at Eau Claire, certainly UW-Milwaukee, there have been sit-ins there. So I think that there are many, many different sectors of this movement that are moving. That said, one of my ongoing frustrations, and I do have some frustrations of the last couple of months, is that despite the fact that at moments we have been able to get different age groups and different people of different race groups or people coming from different racial backgrounds or folks coming from urban and rural areas, people who are in organized unions and those who are unorganized, small business people and also folks who work in the cooperative sector into the same room or at the same rally together, it has been somewhat difficult to make those relationships lasting, right? And that is something Wisconsin Wave has been working very consciously to try to achieve. So, you know, when Freedom Inc. and Operation Welcome Home and Take Back the Land began their housing occupation at 6304 Hammersley Road a couple weeks ago, we mobilized people who were not involved with those organizations to come out and support them. And that, by the way, is still happening. M&I Bank is foreclosed on a property, and there is a family that is staying there, that is living in this residence, and insisting that M&I Bank sell the property to the Community Land Trust here in Madison to become something that is actually lived in as opposed to just a vacant home, right? So, you know, we've been working to turn out folks from the teachers union, from the firefighters, from campus, from family farm organizations to support them. By the same token, you know, lots of students came out, as you pointed out, to support organized labor, to support my union, but I have yet to see the same level of support from the unions for the student protests, and we need to see more of that. So we've been working to turn out union folks and small business folks as well to support the students. So we have to continue to consciously do this work, because otherwise we do go back to the circles that we live in, right, in our daily routines, and we have to break folks out of that sort of limited perspective that is just natural. So one thing we are doing is that we had what we call the Wisconsin People's Assembly that took place on the weekend of April 9th and 10th here in Madison, and there were just over 300 people who took part at some point over the weekend, and you know, maybe 125 people there at any one point in time, who came in from around Wisconsin, where we really did focus on this question of how do you build a popular movement in which we can all see each other, see what we're going through, and understand and stick with it for the long haul. And there are going to be additional Wisconsin People's Assemblies in other parts of the state, in the Stevens Point area. We're looking at Milwaukee, probably back in Madison later in the summer, over the course of the summer. So we're working to build those bridges. The final thing I just want to say is that Sarah is working on building an alliance of small business owners, not only here in Madison, but statewide, to give voice to those of us who adamantly oppose what Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce is doing to the state of Wisconsin.
Gene.
What do you say we need to do?
This is Gene Farley, formerly chair of the Madison Institute.
What frustrates me the most people don't believe in democracy. When you look at the percentage of people who vote, that's an insult. When you look at the people who keep informed, that's an insult. Many people say they're independent, which means they have no responsibility for whoever runs, because they refuse to get involved to determine who runs, no matter which party. I happen to believe in voting. I happen to believe in democracy. But it is a very frail system if we have an ignorant public.
You know, I think actually this is a bone I have to pick with the left and with liberals and progressives generally, and it's a bone that I have to pick that I think many of us who come from a different generation have to pick with, frankly, older folks who got to see a federal government that sometimes took the side of the people. People my age are not used to seeing the federal government take any kind of corrective action that's positive from a progressive point of view. And so I actually don't think that people are being lazy or stupid and not voting in these elections. I don't take that as a sign of a lack of faith in democracy. I do take that as a sign of a lack of faith in our elections and in our system of government and in its efficacy in terms of delivering results. And I think the example you gave of the 2010 election is a perfect example of that. In 2008, the demographic that voted in the highest percentage was African Americans. Okay? African Americans voted the highest percentage in terms of voter turnout compared to all other ethnic and racial groups. The demographic that voted in the highest percentage in terms of age cohorts was 18 to 24 year olds. Okay? That was true in 2008. And that is frankly why Barack Obama was elected president. Okay? In 2010, those turnout rates halved in both communities. Okay? They actually more than halved in the case of young people. So I think what that reflects is a disengagement from the electoral process I don't think it's a wise disengagement, but it's not entirely irrational. And so my response to that is, again, to build other ways for people to get involved in asserting their democratic rights and to find ways to bring democracy again to the classroom, to the campus, to the community, to the local economy, and that when people become engaged in a meaningful way in those types of campaigns, then you might have them for voting cynically, but at least voting at the voting booth.